By larger lights, you mean they make small and large version of this? Go ahead.
USL, the one that I have is for portable use. You put it in a camera bag and you take it on location.
Interesting. So, good old Thomas Edison, guarantee he would be rather amazed as to what all this has developed into. Very similar to Dr. Reed Fisher, W2CQH. Had a lot to do with the development of a cell phone. And there are now something like 7.5 billion, with a B, cell phones in use. There's approximately one cell phone for every human being on planet Earth right now, because quite a few people have got more than one of them. And when it comes to the Internet of Things and remotely controlling things, and iPhones and whatever, boy, we've come a long way. Anybody with any further comments on the subject of a fancy lighting, give me your call letters right now, K2RFW. It was Joe, W-H-R-Y-Y, who got us on this subject. And Joe, do you need any fills? Have we got onto the, finally gotten onto the subject that you're really asking? And do you need any fills on any of the above? W-H-R-Y-Y, the guy who started the question, K2RIW. Go ahead, Joe.
No, negative, Dick, W-H-R-Y-Y. Don't need any fills. They're just listening in. Very interesting subject to talk about. And so forth. So I'm clear, listening.
Yeah, I'm going to break away for a minute just to, from our normal list to go back to a subject with Steve. KD2HUC, if you're still available, Steve. I've heard you discussing the third rail of either the subway or Long Island Railroad, but electrified trains and the third rail, which has something like 600 or 700 volts of DC on it. During Superstorm Sandy, there were portions of tracks which were underwater, and the third rail was sitting there bubbling away. First of all, my main question on that is that just boiling away the water, you know, because the water is salty in the case of portions of Hurricane Sandy, or other minerals get mixed into it, the water becomes conductive and it boils away with the third rail and the grounding system. If that was AC, like you've got on certain kinds of humidifier, which have two probes into your fluid that gets boiled away in your humidifier, the AC is working in both directions, no problem. But our train system is DC, therefore the current is flowing primarily in one direction. Therefore, not only are we boiling away the water, but we're also doing a kind of electroplating. One of those terminals is sacrificial. You're doing electroplating from one to the other. So, was there significant deterioration of either the third rail or the nearby track because of the electroplating process? I wonder if any of that was available, observable. Steve, if you're there, KD2HUC, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, Dick. In answer to your question, no. First off, it wasn't under, it wasn't Superstorm Sandy. During Sandy, the entire system was de-energized. So even though the tracks were submerged, there was no power. It was during a different event, and there was some inadvertent flooding. And fortunately, I do not believe that there was any corrosion, accelerated corrosion, between the tracks and the third rail. They're pretty hardy pieces of steel. And the current, while it was on for a duration of time, it wasn't long enough to do any damage, any electrolysis damage. KD2HUC, back to net.
Yeah, that's rather amazing. So I guess the current was low enough or the duration was short enough where somebody reported to you that, hey, this particular chunk of track is underwater and boiling away. And so I guess the power was disconnected or the water was removed. So I presume the boiling under that third rail didn't go on for days on end. It was only hours. Is that part of the reason why no accelerated corrosion was observable? Is that what you're saying, Steve? Over to you, Steve, K2RIW.
Yep, 100%, Dick. Here's an interesting figure since you bring up the DC. Do you know that the standard measurement of loss of material is 1 amp of current over 1 year's time will remove 20 pounds of steel from a structure? You ever heard that number before? KD2HUC, back to net.
That is a beauty. When it comes to these rules of thumb of people who are in a particular industry, no, I have never heard that one. 1 ampere of current for 1 year will remove 20 pounds of steel. When it comes to the amount of charge of each molecule of steel, in other words, there's ways of backing that back down to a physics experiment calculation. But I think you're saying the rough rule of thumb, 1 ampere for a year will remove 20 pounds of steel. If I heard you correctly, that's a beauty. Thank you for bringing that to our attention. KD2HUC for some goodies. K2LIW, go ahead, Steve.
It's actually a not-for-profit organization called NACE, and they handle corrosion control, mostly for pipeline industries and other industries where you put a lot of steel underground. But that's their standard rule of thumb. 1 ampere leaving a structure takes 20 pounds of steel with it over 1 year's time. So imagine leaking thousands of amps. You're not going to have much of a structure left. KD2HEC, back to net.
Yeah, I think that third rail is capable of dishing out to 5,000 amperes under certain occasions. Now, when it comes to the steel pipes, sometimes I presume they're really iron pipes that were put in the ground in places like, in your major metropolitan areas like New York City, probably around 1900 or so. Local grounding and local currents that flow from the power supply systems. I'm guessing that there are times when that can be an aggravating factor when you get a sudden burst of a pipe and a whole lot of water comes pouring out. The electrolysis or accelerated corrosion of that pipe could in some cases be electronically aggravated. Is that somewhat true, Steve? KD2HUC, K2IW, the TechNet, if you happen to know.
Absolutely could, and that's one of the methods they use to fight it. They actually connect the rectifier to the pipe and reverse the polarity on it. It's called impressed current cathodic protection, and they actually drive the current so that instead of current leaving the structure, the current leaves the sacrificial anodes and returns to the structure, so that this way there's no loss of material. It's carefully calibrated to ensure that the current doesn't do any damage to anything else in the area, but it's pretty commonplace for underground structures. KDQHUC, back to net.
Is that protection system that you're now describing, I presume it's being used on water pipes and maybe other kinds of conduit that's encasing cables in the manholes. Roughly how many structures do you know of that are using that kind of intentional current flow electronic protection system, whatever it's called? Probably has a fancy name. Back to you, Steve. K2IW.
The short answer is thousands. There's hundreds of them on Long Island. Thousands of them across the country. Like I said, it's very commonplace, especially for metallic structures that were installed in, the first part of the 20th century, where they didn't really have, coatings that could withstand, hold up dielectric strength underground. So they force current on them. It's called impressed current cathodic protection. It's very, very effective until the rectifier fails, but they have alarms and whatnot for that. But, yeah, it is. It's pretty widely used. KD2HUC.
Now, here's a really crazy one, Steve, and maybe I'm going a little off subject. In the case of the Empire State Building, it has a steel structure underneath all that facade that's holding it all together and providing the strength. I'm a little bit worried that there are places where rainwater is leaking in and getting against the steel and corroding. There's currents flowing through that steel. So when it comes to protecting the steel structure of something like the Empire State Building, flow in the world, do you protect every one of those floors? You could have different amount of current flowing into the steel, different on each one of the floors. And I certainly, there were certain key portions of that structure where I really wouldn't want the steel eaten away, because all of a sudden you're going to get a collapse. How in the world do you protect something like that gridwork, that steelwork of Empire? KH2HUC, if you happen to know, K2RIW, go ahead, Steve.
Well, the short answer is bonding. The whole point of corrosion is that when the current leaves the steel, it takes, you know, the ions of the steel with it. If you provide a solid connection so that the current can leave through an intentionally connected conductor, then the presence of the current doesn't accelerate the corrosion. So NEC requires us to bond building steel anytime we derive a power system, so that this way there's any current that's flowing on the steel has a solid, you know, conductor back to the source, and that it won't leave through an electrolyte like rainwater. KD2HUC, back to net.
Were they smart enough to know this way back in 1932 or whenever it was, when that building was being put together? During that original construction, were they smart enough to know where to do all this fancy bonding? What's your guess on that one, Steve? Go ahead.
Well, I don't think the requirements existed back then, but then again, the building's still standing, so I'm sure they have other means or methods that they may have used. Maybe they galvanized certain parts so that the zinc performs sort of a sacrificial cathodic protection on the surface. Maybe they coated it or sealed it with tar or some other compounds that are, you know, highly resistant to water that probably wouldn't meet the health requirements of today's building codes, if you know what I mean. Back then, they had paints and whatnot that lasted a lot longer than the stuff they make now, simply because they're not allowed to use those chemicals. Short answer is, I really don't know, Dick. KD2HUC, back to that.
A perfectly good answer, Steve. A smart man knows what he doesn't know. Okay, we've got a list of Rich, Ed, and Bob in that order. I hope we get a chance to get to each one of them. Rich, N2EO, I think you had a comment you wanted to make. N2EO, K2RIW, go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. A little more than just a comment. A couple of weeks ago, I'm not angry, Boy made the comment that if you're bone patient, if you are your own doctor, you have a fool for a patient. That's not always true. But anyway, everybody on this frequency knows I have a rare neurological disorder called Tourette syndrome. All my life they were saying it's psychological, which turned out not to be. My father was coming home one night, reading the New York Times on the subway, and he read about the illness. A young doctor, not even a doctor, was a second year medical student by the name of Richard Chalice, had two patients. He used a new medication. He read up on it in the library. I don't know how he was able to do that in 1967 because there were no computers. Anyway, my father read the article. When he came home, he didn't say anything to me, but him and my mother called Dr. Chalice and said they'd like to bring me to the... It was Iowa State University. He said, not necessary. There's a doctor in New York by the name of Shapiro, who was also treating Tourette's because he read the same article. I was only his second patient, and I got treatment apropos to the problem. It is not psychological. as psychological. All the tones, but basically it's neurological. So here's a case where we were going along with the experts in New York that had no idea. I'll say this. This doctor trained another doctor, a lady. Her name, you can look her up. Her name is Dr. Ruth D. Bruin. B-R-U-U-N. She just retired last year. A lot of doctors think there's no money to be made treating this. She was always mobbed. She then had a patient coming from Germany. Nobody they could find over there. And I did a little research because the medication I was on had severe side effects. And what you probably know, I found a medication called Navain. N-A-V-A-I-N. It's also known chemically as zeaxanthin. I brought that to Dr. Bruin. She put me on it. It works. So you have to be a little bit wary of all doctors, and you have to be proactive for yourself. Think back to you.
In almost any situation where you're dealing with a complicated situation, a smart person will try to be as educated as possible, try to find out as much as he can, and not just sit back and let somebody else make all the decisions for you. In some cases, you need second and third opinions. There's also going to be misunderstandings from time to time, Rich, because we've got to be careful over the air, ham radio-wise, particularly on the tech net, not to discuss medical situations in general. There's a whole lot of reasons why when a physician is in front of somebody where he can touch them, talk to them, see them, and ask some logical questions and do an analysis, that's very different than trying to make a pronouncement over the air. So there's got to be misunderstandings from time to time as we do our best to try to avoid really discussing medical situations in general. The medical situations and politics and religion are really almost no-no subjects. So there's got to be misunderstandings. And so I don't think anybody has to apologize for what you did here. Let me go over to Roy for another subject. Roy, you're the one guy I know for sure that does monitor the chat room. And so periodically we have to check that people who sign into the chat room and want to say something or want to ask something, that's the only way of doing it. And you're the person monitoring that. So how do we stand on the chat room tonight? AC2GS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Roy.
Yes, Dick. Well, there's a total of four people who checked in, counting me. The other is John, KC2SHO. Paul checked in for a while, WS2N. And Andy, N2HUH, checked in for a while. And now a new person, N2APG, just checked in. But no one's kind of projected any questions towards you, otherwise I would have told you.
Glad to hear that. I'm going to be checking with you periodically to make sure. All right, Ed was the next person. He's still with us. Sorry to keep you waiting so long, Ed. K2GJE, K2LIW. Go right ahead, Ed.
Good evening, Dick. K2RIW, K2GJE. Just a question of curiosity. If I can feed a fan dipole with one coax, is there any reason why two Yankees on the same boom could not be fed with the same coax? Over.
With smarts, one single transmission line, in many cases, can feed multiple antennas simultaneously that are on different frequencies. So a dipole, for instance, made for 80 meters. If that piece of coax cable was feeding an 80-meter dipole and a 40-meter Yagi simultaneously, that could be made to work like a charm, because the 80-meter dipole, giving a beautiful 73-ohm impedance at 80 meters, to 80 meter dipole is almost a pure open circuit at 40 meters, so it automatically switches itself out. And the Yagi at 40 meters would be absorbing the power. You have to worry a little bit now about the method by which you feed the 40 meter Yagi, in my example. What's it doing on 80 meters? If it's got a certain kind of a feed system that's capacitively coupled on 80 meters, it could be a pure open circuit. And if it's fed with a loop of wire, it might not be. So, with some smarts, there are multiple ways in which a single transmission line without a switching network can feed multiple antennas. The next step beyond that is to put a multiplexing filter there. If you've got a filter network, let me drop... A filter network, which has your common piece of transmission line going into it, and then it's got a 40-meter output, an 80-meter output, and a 20-meter output of the filter, and those appropriate outputs go to the right antenna, then you've done the Cadillac approach, belt and suspenders. But in many cases, when you're smart enough, and you can, your first clue as to whether or not you're smart enough is by either calculation or measurement, maybe with an antenna analyzer, what is the true impedance of each one of your antennas on each of the frequencies of interest. In the case of the 80-meter dipole, you'll find out with your antenna analyzer that it's almost a pure open circuit, thousands of ohms of impedance at 40 meters, but a good impedance at 80 meters. And testing your Yagi, your 40-meter Yagi in my example, would also tell you. So by testing, by calculating, yes. In general, can it be done? I say the answer is yes if you're smart enough. And it's a darn good question. And we can... There are guys who think they're forced to have four antennas on the tower and they've got to have exactly four transmission lines. Not necessarily so. K2GJE, each situation is different, but you're a smart enough guy and you're enough of an analyst and you can ask the right questions of the right people. I know you can make it work if you want to at K2GJE, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I had the same opinion. I thought that the antenna that was off frequency, even though it might take a little power, the SWR and the impedance would be so far off that there would be no need to have separate feed lines. It was just was my opinion and just a question of curiosity. Back to that, over.
And to Guido, comment.
Yeah, there's a kind of multi-band Yagi dipole-like structure. I can't think of the name of it right now, where a guy puts a 80, a 40, a 20, a 50, and I think they call it a fan dipole. A fan dipole automatically does that kind of switching for you. That the other energy will go down the right dipole because it's the only one that presents a good impedance most of the time. So a fan dipole is a good example of this. I wonder if you've also put up multiple antennas on one transmission line, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW.
N2EO. No, I haven't. But I know what works here. A center-fed dipole fed with open wire line. You know I like open wire line. And you need a balun, a 2-to-1 balun, to go from the line, the open wire line, to coax. And then you go to the output of your antenna tuner, which is necessary. And like you've often said, Dick, you don't have to feed it at the center. You can feed it at one end or anywhere. And if it should be a minimum of, what is it, halfway, to make it on the lowest frequency you want to go. And that's it.
E2FIU.
That dipole-like structure is really a resonator, a little bit like a flywheel. And so you can put a push rod on a flywheel near the center, near the pivot point, that's a low impedance point, or near the perimeter, it's a high impedance point. And so with the right kind of a structure, you can feed a flywheel in lots of ways. A dipole-like antenna and many other kinds of antennas. Most of our antennas are resonant structures. Resonant means there's a lot of energy bouncing around inside, and there's multiple ways you can feed it. And there are people who think one way of feeding is more efficient than another. Done with the right kind of smarts, all of these various ways of feeding an antenna can all be made close to 100% efficiency. Let's see what George got to say on all the above. KD2FIU, K2RIW. Go ahead, George.
Yeah, I'll be quick about this. It's really not input here. It's part of the question. And the name of the device you mentioned at the end of the coax for the multiple band, for the multiple antennas. And I guess the gentleman that brought the question in was referring to antennas that are basically tuned to the frequency he wants. I'm assuming that at this point. So, Dick, what was the name of the device that you mentioned again? I was a little too far away to hear it. And are the antennas tuned so that we're not using a tuner in front of the radio? Two questions, Dick.
A single transmission line going to multiple antennas, there's multiple ways of doing it. If you're lucky, or if you're smart in the way you design the multiple antennas, direct connection of all of the antennas all to the exact same piece of transmission line, maybe not at the exact same point. Maybe one of them's at the end of the transmission line and the other one's connected to 3 feet back, so to speak. But there are multiple ways, if you're smart enough, that multiple antennas can go to one transmission line. That's a simple approach with the right selection of antennas and methods of feeding them. The Cadillac approach, to be double darn sure, is called a multiplexing filter. Not a diplexing filter, not a duplexing filter, a multiplexing filter. If I wanted to feed an antenna in a super safe manner, I know I've got an 80-meter antenna, a 40-meter antenna, and a 20-meter antenna. Let me drop. With inductors and capacitors, with the right kind of a layout, inside of a shielded box, maybe, it's possible to make a multiplexing filter where your single transmission line goes into this filter network. It's weatherproofed. It's up at the top of the tower. And it's got three output connectors, one for 80, one for 40, and one for 20. So a multiplexing filter could make believe, could absolutely force the situation where only energy of the right frequency comes out of the right connector. As I said, that's a Cadillac approach. And although it sounds elaborate, by way of the impedance matching network that I told you guys about so often, the college in California. You Google that word of that college plus impedance matching. On each one of the frequencies where you know the impedance, it'll design for you a filter network. So you could put a number of those filter networks together. That's the simple, dumb way of doing it. But there's a more elaborate way of doing it. So a multiplexing filter can definitely do what you're talking about here, George. KD2FIU, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Berkeley,
that's the word I couldn't think of. So you Google the word Berkeley and impedance match, and you tell it, what's the impedance of your transmitter? What's the impedance of your load, the antenna, and what frequency you're operating at? And you press go, in a couple of seconds, it gives you, 15 separate solutions. And you choose the one that you like. So an awful lot of very elaborate filter synthesizing. I mean, you study at a college level filter synthesis. It'll drive you crazy. It's a very, very complicated subject. But that Berkeley program gives you the answer so fast that your problem becomes the opposite problem. Instead of having no solution, you have Saddam many...
Repeater, timeout.
You have Saddam many solutions. You'll have trouble choosing the right one for you. In most cases, choose the one that's the simplest. Back to you, George.
Okay, that's the word I missed. Thank you very much, multiplexing filter. And I heard somebody come in. It was Berkeley impedance match. Thank you, Dick. KD2FIU.
Yeah, whenever you've got a wild impedance at your particular favorite frequency, your antenna might be 347 ohms of capacitor reactance and 14 ohms of resistance. You go to that Berkeley program, you give it that information as the load, and say, how do I find a solution to this? And tell what frequency you're operating at, and what's the impedance of your transmitter. your source, your signal generator, and in general, it'll give you 15 solutions. As I said, choose the one you like. In fact, it'll give you an L network, an inverted L network, a T network, a pi network, a TL, an LT, a pi L, and so on. All of these networks, choose the one that you like. And in some cases, an inverted L might not do it, but the ordinary L will do it. And it'll tell you that there is no solution for that particular layout, for that particular frequency combination, if you know what I mean. But it gives you lots of solutions, all worked out with ridiculous accuracy. Okay, the next person on our list was, Bob, KD2, November, Uniform, Bravo. Hope you're still with us, Bob. Sorry to keep you waiting. K2IW in the TechNet.
Hi, Dick. This is Bob. Actually, it's KD2, November, Victor, Bravo. Yeah, I have a question about magnetic loops, and maybe no one will even have an answer because it's about a couple specific brands, and I'm looking for some that can get more power because, let me drop. I'll mention the three loops I'm looking at. There's a chameleon F loop. There's an alpha loop that claims to be able to do 100 watts, but I'm wondering how valid that claim is because they used to say 30 for the same antenna. And then those are the main ones. There's another one called Precise Loop that can do 45 watts. And I don't have any HF antennas now, and I'm hoping the loop will work in my home, but if it does not, I want it to be a portable one that I can take out to the park, which is not too far from Prospect Park. So maybe no one can help me, but maybe someone has some opinions or some stuff about some of these loops have these claims of extra power over the standard power seasoning. I just wanted to know if anyone had any knowledge of this. I need to get more specific. I just want to get back to you for now.
Yeah, it was a magnetic loop antenna that gave me some grief a few months ago, where I made a prediction where the antenna pattern was, and I was dead wrong. Had to correct it a week or two later. The way many guys set up a loop antenna, and K2KEY had used a number of them at his property in Brooklyn. He was using a kind of loop where it was approximately very close to one wavelength in circumference. I think it was either 80 or 160 meters he was using this thing, where it went around almost the perimeter of his property, held up in the air by about 40 feet. And as long as he's using the right kind of wire, I think he was using something like 14-gauge household wire, putting a kilowatt into that thing would be no problem. I mean, the only power limitation might be the balancing device, if he used one. I think he was feeding it with open wire line. So when it comes to power limitation on any of these HF antennas, and even VHF antennas, there's usually a way you can find out real fast where is the power limitation. That is by studying the individual components, what's the power rating of that particular balun, that particular transmission line, and how much current I'm plugging into that wire. Let me drop it. So by using manufacturer's information, by using the recommendations of the guy who wrote the article, there's ways you can anticipate ahead of time, is there a power limitation? Most things that have a power limitation is because of overheating. If you can borrow from somebody a thermal imaging camera, if your particular antenna is rated for 100 watts, and you want to find out really what happens at 100 watts, and you run a key down for a few minutes at 100 watts and look at it with a thermal imaging camera and find out what gets hot. Almost anything that has a limitation, it's heating limitation. You take, for instance, an SMA connector. If an SMA connector, or sometimes called a 3-millimeter connector, rather compact, and if I'm using that thing at 1,000 megacycles, and if I'm putting more than about 20 watts into it, I'm pushing my luck, because the current density of the center pin, the tiny little center pin, starts getting hot. And so if I was looking at that with a thermal imaging camera, I would find it out real fast. Or I can calculate that. So, as I said, in many cases, the power limitation is some particular component because they've used a compact, inexpensive one, and maybe replacing that one particular component can allow you to go to higher power. So, let me drop. don't be completely scared by somebody telling you that this antenna cannot be used at more than 100 watts. If I'm doing it with low duty factor single sideband, I could definitely take a 100 watt antenna, an antenna that can take 100 watt of key down CW, I could probably put 300 watts of single sideband into it, as long as I don't shout a very long oh or something like that into it, because the sideband is only putting out power during the peaks of my speech. The average power might only be 100 watts, even though the peak envelope power would be 300. So there's various ways of getting around this. So my first impression is that if the manufacturer has told you that, believe it at first. But with further investigation, you can find out what the real limitation is, and maybe that inexpensive part that's on the limitation, you substitute it with something a little bit more stealthy, I guarantee you can run it at a much higher power level. A simple small loop antenna, I think it was a 6 meter halo antenna. I remember putting 500 watts into a halo antenna on 6 meters. I wanted to make sure I wasn't close to it while I was doing this, but with proper construction, it could take it. Over to you, Bob. KD2, November, Victor Bravo. Couldn't read my own writing. KD2RIW, go ahead, Bob.
KD2NVP, thank you, Dick. Actually, one of these antennas, I guess I could narrow this down to two specific questions, one for each of the two of these brands. There's one that's the Alpha Loop, and they say that they originally rated this thing, everything exactly the same, for 30 watts, and that is with further testing, we now think we can do 100 watts. I'm talking about SSB or lower for things like CW, 50 for CW, 25 digital. But, and then it says, asterisk, with a properly adjusted mic gain, the system will handle 100 watts PEP SSB. A properly adjusted mic gain is basically one that does not peak your meter when SSB is used. Pardon my ignorance, I'm not sure which meter that is.
KD2FIU.
George recognized. The one place where you've got to be careful with power ratings that I know of for sure is any of these HF antennas that are made super compact. A full-sized 80-meter dipole, for instance, could be made out of maybe 14-gauge household wire, 132 feet long, and maybe fit in the center if that's what you choose to do. And putting a kilowatt into that, no problem. That 132-foot-long dipole on 80 meters, you could make it, instead of 132 feet long, you could make it 30 feet long. You could probably even squeeze it down into a device that only is 5 feet wide and 5 feet high. There's various ways you can do that. And when you make an antenna electronically small, a small fraction of a wavelength in its major dimensions, the Q starts going up extremely fast. So therefore, the energy bouncing back and forth in that antenna, it becomes very narrow band, and a lot of energy is bouncing around, and now you've got to be careful with power, otherwise you'll arc over the tuning capacitor that's built into it. So antennas that have been laid electrically small, that's the first place where limitation usually takes place. I know you asked another question, which I've already forgotten, but maybe George has got the answer for us. KD2FIU, K2RIW, go ahead, George.
I don't have the answer to that question, but I do have a consideration you might want to take into effect here is the near-ground effect and the very near-ground effect primarily and the far-ground effect of working with a loop antenna like that. And it's also how much is going to come back at you, how much is reflected outward, how much is reflected downward. For example, if I had that antenna inside my kitchen between my stove and my refrigerator, I'm going to have some big problems. I have it in my backyard between my metal shed and my neighbor's pool or something like that, or versus I have it out in an open field. So consider very near ground effect, near ground effect, and far ground effect for how much power and how much efficiency you're going to get out of it.
Now, this is one of those situations where you're going to hear two sides to the story. George and I differ a little bit on this one. My experience is that if the nearby metallic objects on even a compact HF antenna, if those nearby metallic objects are, let me pick a number, more than 3 or 4 feet away, their effect is usually extremely minor. That's my experience. George has a different experience. He has built certain antennas where nearby metallic objects further away than that gave him grief. And when it comes to the grief we're talking about, the tuning of the antenna, I can put metallic objects near an antenna. It might change the tuning. If I'm willing to retune the antenna, I can make it work in that environment. I can make it work with high efficiency in that environment. That's my opinion. George differs somewhat on that. He thinks that nearby metallic objects can be knocking down the efficiency, and you might not be able to recover the efficiency. That's his experience. My experience differs. And so, don't completely give up. Interference, and the word interference has got multiple meanings here, but there's a lot of situations where you can make an antenna work in which you think it would never work. A good example is that the early cell phones all had a whip antenna sticking out of the top. An antenna is now squeezed inside. None of them stick on the outside of our cell phones. But the way the manufacturer, let me drop this. The way the manufacturer did that is that you study the schematic or the functional block diagram of that cell phone that you can buy today alongside of almost every single one of those antennas. The very nearest integrated circuit chip is an antenna tuner. The antenna itself doesn't cover all of those frequencies that are required, but that the antenna tuner is smart enough to know that when it's using the 800 meg band, it uses this section of that antenna tuner to force that antenna into resonance. Each antenna, to be high in efficiency, must resonate at that operating frequency. So nearby metallic objects might change your resonant frequency. There's ways of retuning it within the antenna itself or by way of the use of an antenna tuner. That's my experience. Let's see. If some of this makes a little bit of sense, and you're allowed to ask more questions on this one, Bob. KD2, November, Victor Bravo, K2RIW in the TechNet.
AC2GS.
Roy recognized, but Bob first. Go ahead, Bob.
Yes, I my situation, unfortunately, where I was put in my window, the same metal cabinet that works as a ground plane for my current antenna broadcasting, VHF, UHF, with a mag mount, it's also going to be like about 3 feet away from the loop. I also have chicken wire on my walls, I'm almost certain of that. So I know that inside this mix, this and anything may be terrible. But I also, that's why I would get a portable loop so I could also take it out to the park. So at least I could do that. So I'm prepared for it being bad in the house. I'm just going to hope it might not be, or it might be adequate for something. I'm wondering if the null of a loop, like, you know, face the loop going out the window, the null would be facing the cabinet, but it's still 3 feet away, so maybe it would still be very bad. I don't know. Back to you guys.
Yeah, I've got quite a few opinions on this one, but I'll hold them until Roy makes his comment. AC2GS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, thank you very much, Dick. Well, I mean, a magnetic loop is kind of bipolar. So if it's pointing out the window in one direction, it's going to point into your house in the other one. So that probably wouldn't solve it. My understanding of how magnetic loops work is that they're much smaller. They're about at least one-tenth or less of a wavelength in circumference as opposed to a full-wave loop. They have an extremely high Q, and because of that extremely high Q, the tuning variable capacitor that's part of the design has a great deal of voltage on it, and it can arc. And my understanding is it's these capacitors that tend to be the Achilles heel for the power rating of a magnetic loop. And there are people who actually buy surplus vacuum variable capacitors to get it into the higher power range. And I understand that magnetic loops also have a slightly different radiating pattern than a full-wave full-wave loop. And it has a better takeoff angle, and it has less ground absorption and reflection problems. I mean, I've used a magnetic loop about 10 feet off the ground, And it's no different than reports that I've heard from people who raise it, you know, 20 or 30 feet higher. So it's an interesting design, but I think it's the variable capacitor that's kind of the problem with the power rating.
I agree with all of the above, and there's a little bit more to it. There are loops and there are loops. If I'm designing a so-called magnetic loop antenna and assume that I want it to be horizontally polarized, that means the plane of loop is going to be parallel to the ground. And if I want omnidirectional pattern, I want to transmit as much energy north, south, east, and west, that requirement that I just described would force me into making a loop that is very small in circumference wavelength. So it's going to be a small loop. The tuning of it's going to have a very significant capacitor at one portion of the loop, and that capacitor is going to have an extremely high voltage across it because it's a very high Q structure. That's one kind of small loop, omnidirectional. If I'm willing to go to a full size loop, full wavelength and diameter, now there is no, in many cases, there is no capacitor at all. It could be one continuous piece of wire with the only opening is where I'm feeding it, in which case I can put a kilowatt into that. It's reasonably broadband, but it has a much more complicated antenna pattern. It's a little bit more dipole-like in its antenna pattern as far as what gets radiated out to the horizon. So there are loops and there are loops. Small loops, omnidirectional. Large loops can tolerate high power, but they're not omnidirectional. They favor certain directions. When it comes to, let me drop this. When it comes to very nearby metallic objects or conducting objects, changing the tuning of the antenna, if those were nearby conducting objects, from my experience, if they're only a couple of feet away, they can do some changing of the tuning and you can retune. When it comes to nearby objects, changing the pattern of the antenna, that's an entirely different requirement. For a nearby object to change the pattern of an antenna requires that object to be close to half wavelength in some dimension. If I've got a steel file cabinet 3 feet away from my magnetic loop antenna, and I'm operating at, say, 40 meters, is that file cabinet going to change the antenna pattern? Oh, boy. It would take very elaborate laboratory test equipment to measure the difference in the antenna pattern with that file cabinet nearby. Your eye would say, hey, there's a great big shield in that direction. There's going to be a complete shadow in that direction. Your eye will say that. The RF energy, that wave coming out of that antenna on 40 meters, 40 meters is what, 120-foot wavelength, so to speak. That file cabinet is only a couple of feet wide. It's just a small fraction of a wavelength. Is that a significant opaque object to that wave? That wave will just wrap around that cabinet, and that cabinet will look completely transparent to it. So nearby metallic objects, changing the antenna pattern, they got to be close to a wavelength in some dimension to be able to do that. Other than that, the laws of radar cross-section, so to speak, says that it's got too little effective capture area at that frequency. 4 pi A over lambda squared, where A is effective area. And so if it's a resonating object, if by some means you force...
Repeater, time out.
If by some means you force that file cabinet to be resonant at that frequency, if I had to make a file cabinet resonant at 80 meters, by way of winding coils and whatever inside of it, I could probably do that. But I'd have to do some pretty fancy physics to do it. That file cabinet is darn transparent until I get to frequencies probably above 10 meters, if you know what I mean. So changing the pattern by extraneous objects, you'd be amazed how difficult that is to do. If I had a deep null in that direction, and could I adjust the depth of the null? Yes. But when it comes to the jar and the deep null, when you've got it in an antenna pattern, it's usually over a very small number of degrees. Most antennas, though, 95% of the antenna pattern is a much wider thing. And to change that pattern by nearby metallic objects, as I said, unless the object is close to a wavelength diameter, it ain't there. You can change the pattern. That's what your directors are doing in the case of a Yagi antenna. but those directors have to be darn close to a half wavelength to be able to do it. Other than that, they don't have the effective capture area. And that's some of what we're looking for here, Bob. I know there's a lot more to this than first meets the eye. KD2, November, Victor Bravo, K2RIW. You got it, Bob.
I think you're saying that it's not a significant size, that this is a cannon that's like, I don't know, maybe 2 to 2.5 meters tall, and, you know, half a meter deep, and, you know, and 3 feet away, maybe less than a meter away from the end. But I like to divert to another question up there. You know, part of this, the power handling is just, which I've been reading a bunch, they seem to get very high reviews for, you know, build quality and integrity in their advertising and everything. But there's this claim they have something called a power compensator that you kind of screw on to the side of the capacitor, I believe, and it supposedly increases, like, its power rating to, like, 2.5 times. In other words, an SSD from about 25-watt limit to a 60-watt limit. But no one really explains what exactly this thing is. I'm just maybe a little dubious about it, but I don't know if any of you have ever heard of this or could imagine what it might be. Throw that out there to you guys. Back to net control.
I'm going to make some guesses on this one, so I'm going to give you a little bit of warning that I'm not 100% confident in what I'm about to say. If I've got an electrically small loop antenna, or some other kind of antenna that I have electronically, I have mechanically squeezed down the antenna, but forced it into resonance. It's got to be resonant in order to have high efficiency for radiating. So I force the antenna into resonance. The antenna has physical dimensions that are a small fraction of a wavelength. In almost all cases, that antenna I just described is going to be high in Q. It probably has a loading capacitor somewhere. And that loading capacitor running at a high Q antenna probably is developing a fierce voltage. As I start shrinking down an antenna, the Q goes up real fast. And so if I take an antenna that would be on 80 meters, 132 feet long, and I force it into a package that is only 5 foot wide and 5 foot high, the antenna probably is going to go to a Q of 1,000. A Q of 1,000, what does that mean? The word Q has got about 5 meanings. Voltage rise at resonance. Current rise at resonance. Center frequency divided by bandwidth. That's another definition of Q. Energy stored per cycle versus energy dissipated per cycle. Rise time and fall time. So let's just talk about the 1,000 Q antenna. I've squeezed it down, and so somewhere in the antenna, the current is 1,000 times higher than the current coming down my transmission line. Somewhere in the antenna, somewhere else, the voltage is going to be 1,000 times higher. So if I'm operating the antenna at a power level which normally would have 50 volts on it, on the transmission line, and I've got a Q of 1,000, I'm going to be putting 50,000 volts somewhere. It's probably across that loading capacitor. Let me drop. So when I go beyond the 50 volt level, which maybe is 50 watts, the number's not exactly right, but you know what I mean. And I'm now going to arc over that capacitor. If I'm willing to use an expensive vacuum variable capacitor, I can make it tolerate a lot more than 5,000 volts or 50,000 volts. But there's multiple ways I can build that capacitor. Rather than have the capacitor with a 1-inch gap and it's going to arc over at that particular voltage, I can use larger plates for that capacitor, and now I get the same amount of capacitance with a greater spacing between the two plates. Now those plates can tolerate a much higher voltage because of the greater spacing, even though the capacitance is the same and the tuning is the same. So when it comes to HF frequencies, you'd be amazed how physically large you can make the plates of the capacitor, still come up with the same amount of capacitance, come up with a larger spacing, and no real significant change in the way the antenna behaves. The capacitor, as long as the capacitor doesn't start approaching a wavelength, it behaves in ways that are very friendly. Also, there are ways I can synthesize that capacitor with a coaxial stub. I can take the right length of coaxial cable, short-circuit it at the far end, make it more than a quarter wavelength long, and that the chunk of of shorted coaxial cable will act like a capacitor. If I'm using high enough power rating, RG8 or RG217, if I'm using really stoochy, maybe Andrew Heliacs, if you know what I mean, if I use really fancy coaxial cable, I can synthesize an extremely high power capacitor in a rather small structure. So there's a zillion ways of solving this, but understanding the physics.
Repeater, time out.
The general rule of thumb, if I'm shrinking the antenna down so that it's a small number of wavelengths in physical dimension, it's going to be high in Q. Go to the right reference, you can predict how high the Q is going to be. Once you know how high the Q is going to be, you know how high the voltage has to be somewhere within that antenna. Q is voltage rise at resonance or current rise at resonance, both at the same time, by the way. So, and now can I design a capacitor that can tolerate that higher voltage without arcing over, without having a high dissipation? If I'm smart enough with the right materials, the answer is definitely yes. So when I buy it off the shelf, maybe it will not do, that antenna will not do what I want. But if I understand the physics of it, I can make modifications to that design, and I can make it operate at the power level I want it to operate at. I know that this is possible, and I'm not breaking the laws of physics to do it once I understand those individual concepts as to how an antenna works. An antenna is a resonant structure. The energy has to bounce back and forth in there until it finally gets radiated. If the antenna is physically small, very little power gets radiated on each bounce. But when the right number of bounces take place, the energy does get radiated. If the materials I'm using are low enough in loss, I can still have a high efficiency antenna, even though it's high in Q. It's going to be very narrow in bandwidth. When I Q is high, I'm going to have to retune it. But if I'm willing to live with that, there's ways you can make this work. There's a lot of ways of doing it. There are more than 5,000 kinds of antennas, Bob. And within each antenna type, you'd be amazed how many variations can be made. Don't give up on this one if that's what you want to do. KD2, November Victor Bravo, putting a super performance antenna into a small apartment. KD2RIW, you got it, Bob.
Push.
Bob, push. Go ahead, Bob.
Thank you, Dick. So this thing, it looks like a disc. And it just kind of, I think it, yeah, it seems like it just screws onto the side of the capacitor. So you're saying it could possibly, maybe it's kind of like your stub you were talking about. Maybe it's a glorified stub. It's this thing you buy it with the antenna, or it's an extra $100 and it screws on. So it could possibly be as good as if you had a capacitor itself was originally designed to handle, you know, a bigger spacing at all, to handle that power, and whether that power would be as efficient, you know, can handle the power, would it actually go to useful, you know, radiation? I guess there are a lot of questions here, and I guess you can't even know the answers to this, this thing is, but you're saying this is very possible. That's what I get. I don't get all the details of the understanding, but I'm still learning all this, but thanks. Yeah, back to you. I'm sure everybody else has to say.
By way of the high-power coaxial cable, coaxial stub assembly, if I take a piece of Andrew Heliacs, 7/8 inch diameter, I may only need a foot or two of it, so to speak, on certain VHF frequencies. But by way of the coaxial stub, I can synthesize an extremely high-power inductor or high-power capacitor. I might synthesize the inductor. Ordinarily, you would synthesize an inductor with a small a stub that is less than a quarter wavelength long and it's got a short circuit at one end. Make it longer than a quarter wavelength, it becomes a capacitor. And you can calculate exactly how many picofarad of packed capacitance it's going to have if you tell me what is the length of that stub, at what frequency, and it's got a short circuit at the end of it. The length versus capacitance is a beautiful calculation. I can give you the formula for that. Not very complicated. So that's a short-circuited stub. I can synthesize a capacitor by a stub that is open-circuited and less than a quarter wavelength long. I can synthesize that an inductor by less than a quarter wavelength of short circuit. So less than and greater than a quarter wavelength, short and open, they flip back and forth as to which is an inductor and which is a capacitor. And the coaxial stub can be an extremely high-power capacitor or an extremely high-power inductor with high efficiency. It won't dissipate any of that energy. And if they're per se, and if the rest of the antenna, the wire of the loop itself is large enough in diameter, it may take copper tubing to make it in order to be able to do that, but there's still ways you can do it. So if you can tolerate a narrow bandwidth, high Q antenna, and you use the right components, I don't think this device you put on there should be as expensive as $100. If I was doing it with